uncorrelated investments is a term all too frequently employed in the world of investing. And yet history shows that in times of sharp market setbacks and exogenous shocks, assets, although appearing to offer low correlation, often behave very similarly. Underlying reasons typically being the rush to raise liquidity and reduce risks by market participants simultaneously. But litigation funding would appear to have very different characteristics. And here to discuss and explain the evolution of this niche asset class and the investment opportunity, I'm delighted to have Robert Rothkopp, founder and managing partner of Balance Legal Capital. Robert, welcome to this Money Maze Podcast private podcast.
Simon, thank you very much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. Well, I hope today we will drill down into this investment opportunity and understand, first of all, why following your very successful career as a litigator with Herbert Smith, you and your colleagues with equally stellar legal backgrounds have been so excited by the potential investment returns in this space, but also how you've constructed the business, the fund vehicles that you have been using, the investment and risk frameworks, the potential returns and timelines, the competitive landscape, and allocating capital and exits. So lots to talk about, Robert.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating asset class and a fascinating space to be in. You touched on the fact that this is an uncorrelated space, and you're absolutely right. In a nutshell, litigation finance is the non-recourse funding of legal disputes in return for a share of any settlement or proceeds from that process. And whilst litigation is a risky process, the returns can be multiples of the capital invested, but the outcome of the litigation itself, whether the case wins or loses, is subject to a court or a tribunal process that is wholly independent of the wider economy. I was going to say, you know, we've even seen that litigation can almost be counter-cyclical in that economic downturns generally precede more business disputes, more breach contracts and sharp practices, and therefore more litigation. We've also been very lucky to notice that litigation finance is effectively COVID-proof. We have lawyers running cases. They can keep working remotely, as do the judges hearing those cases. And I often reflect on how lucky we are to be in an industry that's so well suited to the modern wonders of remote working technology.
I knew you'd make a concise definition that would prevent me from having to stumble through this. So we're going to talk about this in a lot more detail. And I do note, in terms of trying to size the opportunity, that in one of the legal reviews, the value of court cases and cash directly held by UK litigation founders increased 400% over the last 5 years, from 378 million to 1.9 billion. So this is not a trivial space. But let's just dial back a little bit, if I may. Could you just provide a brief recap on your education and the legal career that you are, you know, you are advanced in, but not advanced by age by any means?
Well, yeah. So I started off my education career. I studied biochemistry at Oxford University and then switched to doing the accelerated law degree at BPP in London. I was always interested in science and still am, but the decision to depart from it as a career was easy. I realized that life in the lab was not for me. I found it too solitary, required too much patience, whereas my summer jobs at law firms and investment banks that I was doing at the same time, I found to be energizing, pacey, as well as intellectually stimulating. And I chose Herbert Smith. I was offered a vacation job there, and really liked the people. They were kind enough to offer me a training contract, which sponsored me through the law conversion course. And I didn't realize then that Herbert Smith was also the leading litigation firm in the UK. And once I got there, I angled my training towards dispute resolution. I enjoyed building cases, piecing together the evidence, arguing a point of view. And Herbert Smith was a fantastic place for me. I spent time in the London teams doing international dispute resolution. I spent time in the Moscow office, very different place. And I was also seconded to one of the firm's largest clients, BP, where I was part of the specialist dispute resolution team there. And that was also a terrific experience because from a relatively early stage, I was tasked with looking after a portfolio of cases that BP in its vast business empire was facing. And sometimes I was the only litigator managing the case. Other times I was instructing external law firms and actually got to sit in the position of a client and realize what it is that makes a good litigator, a good legal advisor in helping businesses make tough decisions.
I was about to ask, what do you think makes a good litigator?
That's a really good question. I've decided that it's a mix of real attention to detail. That's where the devil is, with the ability to take a strategic view that allows the actual litigant, the business, to make a decision. Litigators have to be tenacious. They have to read not only the client, they have to read their opponent. They have to recognize opportunities for settlement, opportunities to win the key points, and have a good read on the decision maker, that being the judge or the arbitration panel that is deciding the dispute. So it's a mix of skills.
So you have this very successful career with a very renowned law firm, and you decide that establishing balanced legal capital is the next step. What was your thinking? What was the trigger?
So my final chapter at Herbert Smith was a posting to help them set up their New York office in 2012. And I had 2.5 fantastic years living in East Village and working in Manhattan, in Midtown. And it was there that we were instructed by an existing US litigation funder to advise them on a litigation investment. And the funder was looking to invest around £5 million. And if the case settled or won at trial, they would take out £25 million from the proceeds. And I just thought, wow, here's a business that turns litigation into an alternative asset, where if you pick the right cases, the capital invested is asymmetric to the returns you can make. And you're helping businesses and individuals obtain justice in a different way to just being the lawyer advising on the case. And I realized that this thing, litigation finance, was going to be a key part of the litigation landscape and the investment landscape in the future for various reasons. You know, businesses like litigation finance. They can de-risk their litigation instead of paying the expensive legal bills themselves or month to month. Litigation finance takes the cost of fighting cases off their balance sheet and gives them an extension, really, to their strategic team. The fact that a funder has scrutinized the merits and decided to put their own capital in is an endorsement of the case. And the variety really struck me.
So you established Balanced Legal Capital in 2015. And I wonder whether you could just briefly describe the organization and how you and your partners thought about how it should look.
Well, I guess it sounds pretty obvious to say now, but we realized that to run a successful litigation fund, you need to be able to originate and select the right cases. And that requires a team of the best litigators with strong origination relationships. But it also requires a rigorous, objective case selection process, which means fending off all the difficult human tendencies of biased decision-making and so on. But we really focused on recruiting those senior, top-flight litigators. The first person I managed to get on board was Lord David Gold. He's often described as the king of litigation. He joined our investment committee. He was formerly the senior partner of Herbert Smith and had left recently to start his own strategic advisory firm and to join the House of Lords. Now, David is a well-known, shrewd litigation strategist. He was brought in by Roman Abramovich in his massive case against Boris Berezovsky that took over much of the London legal community back in the day. So David provides that wealth of experience and strategic view, and had been somebody I knew at the firm. We also brought in Ian Terry. Ian Terry was the managing partner of Freshfields globally, and also head of their global dispute resolution practice. And again, another venerable name in litigation. One of his most famous clients was Steve Jobs, who turned to Ian when Apple was sued by the Beatles. And we were lucky to know Ian because Ian was the boss of my other partner, Simon Burnett, who joined me in building this business very early on.
So, in fact, you referred to Lord Gold as I was doing my research here. In fact, I saw him described as the city's most fearsome litigator. So I certainly hope I never find myself on the other side of that particular courtroom. But I'm intrigued as to how you go about identifying these situations.
Yes. So we have some deep relationships in law firms, insolvency practitioners, and some other corporates. Lawyers often find themselves in situations where they have clients with good cases, but the client, for whatever reason, wants to share the risk. They may have the money to finance the case themselves, or they want to get some assistance from a third-party funder. And because of the high caliber team, we have got some excellent relationships with law firm partners who know that we have the expertise in-house to understand the objectives and the underlying litigation.
I think a lot of potential investors will understand the screening process, because in the world of stocks, you might start with 15,000 stocks and you'll narrow it down through a series of filters, and technology will help you there. Tell me a little bit about how you go about identifying and prioritizing the cases that you want to really get involved with.
Well, that's a really, really good question. We have to apply rigorous criteria to our case selection process. And you're right, you don't get to look at a huge amount of market data. There's no Bloomberg terminal out there that can give you performance of litigation cases in that you're looking to invest in. You have to make the decision yourself. We have invested in far less than 5% of the case opportunities that we look at. We focus on mid to high value commercial disputes and class actions in the UK and Australia and other common law jurisdictions outside of the USA. And that means the case has got to have quantum. Quantum means the amount that's in dispute being claimed for the breach of contract or the breach of tort, whatever the case might be. But the quantum has to be well north of £10 million. The case has got to have strong merits. That means that the prospects of success are high. We have to get comfortable that the alleged breach really did cause the loss that's being claimed. We have to see that there is the right evidence to prove it, either on the documents or with key witnesses. And we have to stay very skeptical and test our assumptions. And that has been, I think, one of the biggest challenges. We don't touch jurisdictions where the courts are unreliable. We have to trust our funded client, understand their objectives. And we will frequently reject cases where the merits are strong, but the defendants either don't have the money to pay the judgment, or their assets are in a jurisdiction where enforcement is just too difficult. And that unfortunately means there's much of the world we don't touch. We also don't do things like family disputes or personal injury, or as far as possible, we are focusing on commercial business-to-business disputes or class actions, less emotional, more rational dynamics. And crucially, we want to make sure that we are backing the right legal teams. So that means the best solicitors, the best barristers who have the competence to prosecute the case properly. And we've understood more and more, I think, since we started this, that the right lawyers are key. And then there's also this aspect which we care about, but investors we find also care, is that we make sure that the cases we pick have a strong access to justice theme. We want to be on the right side. We apply the front page of the paper test to our investment decisions. And anything that would cause reputational harm to us or our investors, we avoid. Anything that, doesn't sit right with us. So, for example, we've turned down cases against universities or impoverished island nations or hospital trusts, anything that would be unnecessarily sensitive or provocative. And I'm glad to say we've built a portfolio of a wide variety of cases, diversified by jurisdiction and claim type. And in the class actions we're doing, we're really holding to account corporations that have wronged individuals who would otherwise be unable to seek recourse to justice. Just it simply wouldn't make economic sense to structure it in any other way. And we're helping businesses in professional negligence claims, in other breach of contract claims, recover assets that otherwise might be left fallow.
So I understand this due diligence you're talking about. And again, it's very much sort of, you know, a parallel with what happens in the sort of in the liquid asset market space. But how wide will you go in your due diligence? You know, fund managers who are researching, you know, a particular sector will talk to industry experts. They'll talk way beyond the immediate financial community to understand the whole sort of ecosystem. So for you, where reputation is so important, how wide will you cast your net to gain confidence?
Well, we get most of our direct information on a given case from the solicitors, the legal team who interact with the client and have given the initial advice. And we will test the investment proposition, the case theory, with the lawyers, with the barristers on the case. And we'll also seek to speak to the key witnesses at the business that has the claim, the claimant entity, and really try to understand whether the loss that is being claimed was really caused by the breach of the defendant. So that's on the micro, or rather, you know, looking at the elements of the case. We will make sure that we really test whether a given law firm has got the competence. You know, we've got our own experience as a team from being in the market to know which lawyers are the best ones, but we are always keen to bolster that intel by talking to others in the market. If the case is within our own background and our own expertise, we can do due diligence and come to a view on whether the case is going to win or not ourselves. Obviously, nothing's ever certain, but we can make predictions based on our team and our own expertise. In other instances, we will go to industry specialists, expert witnesses in quantum. If there is a technical issue in the case, we will also speak to experts there to get an independent view rather than only look at it through the lens of the presenting claimant and their team.
So you've done the research, you've reduced this subset. In the investing world, somebody has to pull the trigger and decide that you're going to go with this particular case. Tell me how that works.
Yes, that is really a process that we have been seeking to hone. We're all, you know, expert litigators, and so we know what questions to ask, but we have been very careful to ensure that we build a selection process that maintains objectivity. So the individuals in our investment committee bring vast experience of litigation, but I don't want the investment committee to simply follow the loudest voice in the room in the meeting. I want to capture the independent views from each of us. So we meet as an investment committee twice a week, generally once to discuss UK investments, the other time to discuss Australian investments. Those are our two core markets. And that frequency allows us to move more quickly, which is something that our law firm partners and our claimant companies like. But in terms of keeping our investment process objective and rigorous, we use a proprietary tool that we've developed. We call it Hawkeye, which is designed to minimize groupthink and cognitive biases when making investment decisions. So each member of the investment committee scrutinizes the investment memo and the papers and the barrister's opinions and provides independent scores on key aspects of the case. before our investment committee meeting. So that means we're rating the quality of the evidence, the quality of the legal teams, the enforcement risk, the recoverability risk. And we each make our predictions about settlement prospects or trial outcomes. Scores are shared at the meeting for the first time so that we capture all views and then can focus on just the areas of disagreement, which also means we can use the time more effectively. And so far, we have been working on requiring unanimous approval from the five members of the investment committee before we go ahead with making an investment. And whilst our team has a broad range of direct commercial disputes and class actions experience, we do most of the due diligence in-house, but sometimes the investment committee will come to a view that actually we need to obtain one extra independent opinion from a specialist barrister in the given field or quantum experts to test a final element of the investment proposition. And then a lot of this business involves execution of the deal, which is by no means a straightforward process.
So I'm very clear now about how that process operates. You've got a finite amount of capital that you're going to utilize in pursuing these cases. How do you allocate that capital between these various opportunities?
So we don't want to sink too large a proportion of our portfolio into the same case type or have cases be vulnerable to the same change of law or any of these factors that can knock out your case. So we make sure that we have a strict investment, single investment size limit that's been growing as we've grown our AUM over time. And if we need to do an investment that requires more capital than that, then we actually have out of our LP or our investor base, we have some investors who are very keen on doing co-investments. So we can put together deals of almost any size, which is great. The diversity in the portfolio actually evolves fairly organically because we've got origination from diverse sources in the UK and Australia, and there's a huge variety of different kinds of disputes that are taking place. It's quite rare that we will have a battery of the same types of cases where that you might be concerned about that concentration risk. For the most part, we are looking at specific disputes between companies that are not generic and based on the same issues.
So it's classic portfolio diversification. Now, your firm balanced legal capital has been described in Chambers and Partners UK Guide. I must confess, it's not a typical part of my weekly reading, as up and coming and hungry and a market disruptor. But the thought that kept on coming back to me was, how do you manage your own time constraints? And that's all of you around that investment committee. It's a bandwidth issue.
Yes, and that is a real challenge. I mean, those kind words, I don't know who they spoke to, but we're grateful for that, because we have really tried to build a speedy investment decision process. And I think that mention of disruption refers to the fact that we have really tried to be great partners with our law firm and corporate colleagues. We've managed to carve out a space in this market by being really good to work with, by being, as it describes us, you know, hungry and motivated. And that speed of decision and frankly, our independence of decision making, we are in the lucky position of having full delegated authority over the capital that we manage. Some of our competitors are backed by hedge funds, where actually the investment committee is actually sitting at the hedge fund behind them. So we have managed to deliver in timeframes that others can't because of that. People know that they are dealing with the decision maker. In terms of managing our capacity, there can be some cases where you can quickly realize that the amount in dispute is not proportionate to the amount of time that it's going to take to get the deal across the line. And unfortunately, we have to pass on cases that might have good merits but don't fit into the bandwidth of the team and the portfolio. We're not the lawyers running the cases. So once we've made our investment decision, there is active monitoring of the case, but we are not the ones having to draft the briefs and review the documents from the other side. We are, and I'd say that the main way we are looking to manage our capacity is by moving up the food chain, making larger single case investments, working with the best legal teams so that the degree of monitoring and burden on our own team is reduced.
So maybe you could give me an example of a win that sort of encapsulates your firm's competencies.
One case that we're very proud of was a class action that we funded in Australia. It was on behalf of thousands of people who had been misled into purchasing insurance policies, which they were encouraged to take out at the time of purchasing cars on finance. And you can imagine these individuals in the car showroom being told, you know, here's your beautiful new car. All you need to do to get your finance product so that you can drive away today is tick this set of boxes, which, yeah, from a menu of insurance policies that will, we say, bolster your ability to get this finance product. The claim alleged that the insurance policies and those selling tactics were unfair. The claim also alleged that the insurance policies were of no value. So many exclusions that out of the hundreds of thousands of policies sold, no one ever managed to make claims. But the cost of these policies was rolled into the finance products and stung all of these individuals. So we funded a class action against the insurance company seeking compensation for the insurance policy holders. And the case settled in 2020 for $140 million, one of the largest class action results in the jurisdiction. And as a result, the money will go to compensate thousands of people who otherwise would have received nothing. So it was a great result and a good example of the way litigation finance can provide recourse to justice where other processes would not.
And for your investors, am I right in saying that the typical profit share, or should we say the share of the settlement, runs to about a quarter?
You're right. In this instance, we were able to return to investors the capital outlay that we had made back plus 25% of the settlement proceeds.
So let's talk a little bit about where you are. You launched a first fund 3 or 4 years ago, correct me if I'm wrong, and now you're in the process. I think you've already soft closed on a new fund. Tell me a little bit about how that has come about and where you think the opportunities are going to be.
Yeah, so we started in 2015 with the backing of our cornerstone investor, being a single UK family office. They allocated to us a portion of their capital, which we managed for a few years. We then raised a multi-investor fund, which we closed in March of 2020. That really gave us this opportunity to allow the stature of the business to grow. And we've enjoyed this flywheel effect, whereby now that we have real capital to put behind cases, we're able to attract and deliver on the promises that we have had built up with our law firm partners. We have managed to deploy that capital into a range of commercial disputes and class actions in the UK and Australia in a faster period than we expected, which meant that we have now been able to go back to investors with some results, with results of allocations. And I'm glad to say, as you said, we are raising what is now our third vehicle, really, with the same investors, a group of super supportive long-term investors who are reinvesting in this one. And I'm pleased to be able to say that we're now sitting on north of $300 million from a group of LPs who are keen to follow us into the future.
And I suppose that begs the question of who would you consider to be your ideal investors?
I'd say our ideal investors, they are a group of family offices, financial institutions, university endowment funds, investors who understand the need to diversify their own portfolios and cover some uncorrelated assets. We appreciate also investors who are keen to co-invest on certain opportunities that we originate that might fall outside the single case investment limits for our fund.
As we know with all investments, there are pitfalls, and I know that there are others, and we'll talk about the competition in a minute, but there are others, firms who do this, where there have been some issues around the approach to accounting and revenue recognition, and I wonder if you just talk about that.
Yes, litigation assets for some people can be difficult to value, especially when the outcome is not known, that the judgment in a given case might only be due a couple of years hence. There might be enforcement risks that haven't necessarily been considered. One of the large listed competitors of ours got into some difficulty because they were marking up the value of their litigation assets before there had been actual cash realizations. And we have avoided that from the very beginning by always holding our investments at book value. We don't do any kind of markup. It's just we hold it on the balance sheet depending on the amount of capital that we have actually spent on the case. So that means that there's no subjective opportunity for us to mark up our performance. We only book the cash when we've actually received it. And I think that has been of huge comfort for investors to know that there isn't any lack of transparency between what they see on our accounts and the cases themselves.
So that's very clear. Let's just talk about exits and timelines. In the great book by Charles Dickens, Bleak House, and the Jarndyce versus Jarndyce case, he writes, the one great principle of the English law is to make business for itself. And we know that cases can drag on. How should investors think about timelines?
So we make sure that within the portfolio and our modeling, we assume cases will take on average 2.5 to 3 years from start to finish. And we know that some cases can take longer than that, others will be shorter. But for the most part, we are operating in jurisdictions where the court systems are not burdened by those concerns that Dickens wrote about. There will always be some outlier cases that buck the trend and go too long, but our 2.5 year average estimate is based on data that we have from the case report systems that we rely on. You do need investors who are patient in case there could be cases that go on longer than a given fund life. There is a secondary market out there as well, which means that any assets that have not realized by the time a fund has to be wound up and distributions made, there are ways to deal with it. But we always make sure that we take duration into account with our investment decisions. So we're not going to launch a long duration case at the very end of our investment period. We want to make sure that things fit snugly into the fund life.
Now, your firm is a founder member of ALF, and maybe you could just tell me a little bit about what that group was established to do.
Yes, so it's the Association of Litigation Funders of England and Wales. They were a body that was set up and endorsed by the Ministry of Justice as a self-regulatory body for litigation funding. It arose from some reforms that took place in the UK called the Jackson Reforms, which sought to make various changes to the way the courts operated and it really gave some key endorsements to litigation funding in the UK, the endorsement being that it was a tool for access to justice. Part of that endorsement came with the condition that there needs to be some form of regulation in the industry. So whilst the FCA regulates the conduct of investment managers and the way that money is managed, litigation funding itself really relies on the courts, the judges, to make sure that only the best cases are backed and that there isn't any kind of undue influence being exerted on parties to litigation through capital providers. So the ALF's job is really to make sure that funders who are members of it abide by a code of conduct. They have to provide some audited evidence that they have capital to commit to the space. And it's a great organization. It's a very important part of making sure that the litigation funding industry is understood and has a long-term place in litigation in the jurisdictions that we care about.
So as we've discussed, there are other operators in this space. How would you differentiate yourself?
So yes, there are a number of other litigation funders out there. We differentiate ourselves on the basis of speed of operation. Because we're a team of expert litigators by background, we understand the asset class, we can inhale a lot of detail, and we can move quickly. We have weekly investment committee meetings that allow us to iterate through the due diligence process. And we really focus on being good long-term partners and good to work with. One key differentiator comes from our funding, our capital structure. We have complete authority to make our investment decisions. Some of our competition are actually backed by hedge funds that control the investment decision. They have the veto rights at the end of the day. And for us is a very important point. And, you know, and for law firm partners, when they deal with us, they're dealing with the decision makers. So we have a good positive feedback loop in the way our business is structured. We have the high caliber team that attracts high quality cases. Our team and our process move very quickly on due diligence, and we make our independent investment decisions. We add strategic input to the cases we're funding. We're more than just blind capital. And all of these things positively reinforce each other to improve our standing with the best law firms and other case sources, which we think all enhance returns.
And for investors looking at this space, they'll understand that there is inevitable illiquidity. How should they think about potential returns?
So the returns that we are aiming for are roughly 2x multiples of invested capital and with an IRR in the 30s. And you're right, whilst fund structures don't allow investors to come and go as they please, these are long-term investments with the potential for high returns in an uncorrelated manner. I think some investors have seen that in any portfolio, you will lose some cases. We model on the basis that we'll lose roughly 40% of the cases we fund. That's all baked into our investment targets and our projections. And like any other private equity fund, there will be certain cases that perform very well and return the fund.
It's a different asset class. It's an appealing asset class. It suits the type of investors that you described earlier on very well, who have those long-term timeframes. And the payoffs look appealing, which of course then begs the question, which is, I think London is the biggest center of arbitration globally. You're also in Australia. Others will see the market opportunity and enter. How big is the market?
So there have been estimates made that globally only 3% of litigation that's taking place in the major courts is funded. which means there's a vast opportunity really there for the market to grow. Corporates who have traditionally financed litigation themselves now see litigation finance as a genuine, interesting option for them to de-risk their litigation spend and pursue assets, litigation assets that would otherwise be ignored. And the potential for class actions and group recourse also increases as the various, you know, innovative changes are made to the rules in this jurisdiction and in others. So I think there will always be more demand for capital in this space than can be provided. Obviously, risk is in the eye of the beholder, and there will always be cases that want funding that funders don't want to do. But the number of and the quality of cases out there that we see is only improving as time goes on, as the asset class becomes more mainstream.
And looking ahead in 5 years' time, what would allow Robert Rothkopf to give himself a pat on the back?
I would be thrilled to return to investors the projections that we made originally when pitching to them. I see us as long-term investment managers in this space. Balanced Legal Capital will continue to raise funds and deploy them in this space. In 5 years, my hope is that we will be on another fund in addition to the existing funds we've got, and continue to be investing in the best cases with the best legal teams in our jurisdictions. It's about delivering that plan and delivering in a space that allows us to really provide access to justice to our partners.
So I have two concluding questions, which are much more general, which is, when you're not reviewing cases and preparing for disputes, what does your ideal day consist of?
Well, you know, when I'm not thinking about the business, not thinking about the world of litigation finance, I've got a very active family life. I've got two kids under the age of three, and that keeps me very busy. Obviously, when times are normal again, I love to travel and I love to keep fit, runs and bike rides and hang out with friends. That's really what it's all about.
And what advice would you give to the young folks who listen to the Money Maze podcast concerning thinking about a career in law?
So my advice to people thinking about a career in the law is, I would certainly recommend it to them. It's a terrific grounding in analytical skills and a way of thinking that can be applied very broadly. I think I would say to lawyers starting out that you really want to try a range of different disciplines and find out what it is that you really enjoy, and notice that actually you have to be prepared to reinvent yourself as the legal market changes. I think some people think that law is not a very entrepreneurial pursuit. You can join a good law firm and benefit from their goodwill, their business development. But really, to make it in law, you've got to nourish the right relationships and see where they take you.
And is there anything you would tell a 20-year-old Robert Rothkopf?
That's a good question. I would tell him that I was very likely to end up in a totally different place from the research lab I was probably sitting in at the time, and that I would thoroughly enjoy the journey.
I think that's very helpful, because everybody, or many, can be in a hurry and not realize that this is a potentially very long journey. So, Robert, this has been very helpful for people looking at a space that is, if not going to mainstream, is more than just niche. And as an investor, as I am certainly would say that I'm intrigued by the risk-return profile. I certainly acknowledge that its absence of correlation is genuine as opposed to purported. And so that's been extremely helpful. And you have used an expression which I am going to steal, because you said that your expertise as a firm is that you can inhale a lot of detail. I think that's an absolutely terrific way of explaining one of your competencies. Thank you very much for coming on and appearing on this Money Maze podcast special. And I know you've got a very good website as well, Balanced Legal Capital website, which I found helpful as I was doing my research. Lots of clarity there. And we will be putting out all the relevant sort of information of how to be put in touch with you. So Robert, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much for having me, Simon.
All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.